The DART mission is going to create a meteor shower on Earth. An explanation for the WOW signal. Big problems with New Glenn, and JUICE completes a flyby of both the Earth and the Moon. All this and more in this week's Space Bites. NASA's DART mission slammed into asteroid Dimorphos in 2022. As I always like to say, it avenged the dinosaurs. Earthlings are not just going to stand for space rocks pelting us from across the cosmos. No, we're going to hit them back. Well, we sure hit Dimorphos, and astronomers are still crunching the numbers, doing analysis of what happened to this moon, Dimorphos, after the impact from the DART mission. It was a pretty significant change to the orbit, but there was debris that flew away from the impact site out into the solar system. Some of the pieces of debris were moving at tens of kilometers per second, others as fast as maybe 500 kilometers per second. And so this cloud of debris is drifting away from the impact site, and eventually it's going to cross the orbit of Earth and it's going to cross the orbit of Mars. And so researchers wanted to figure out exactly when this was going to happen. And based on their calculations, we could see the first debris raining down on Earth within about 10 years from now. So 2034? And we could see debris starting to hit Mars just a couple of years after that. But that's like the fastest moving stuff that was ejected at the highest velocity. Slower moving stuff is probably going to arrive about 30 years after the impact. And what's really cool about this is that we might get a new meteor shower, which I guess we'll call the Dimorphids. And, you know, most meteor showers are caused by a comet and the tail debris from a comet. But occasionally, some meteor showers are actually caused by asteroids. And so we made a new meteor shower. I guess we'll find out how good it is. If it's like really good, should we make more of them? Both to sort of show what we can do to the asteroids, but also to just give us more and better regular meteor showers? Could we design and make our own meteor storm? What could go wrong? Water on a metal asteroid. NASA's Psyche mission is on its way to asteroid Psyche. Yeah, that's not confusing at all. Name the mission after the asteroid. Anyway, this is a really cool object, asteroid Psyche. It is a chunk of metal. It's thought to be sort of the leftover debris of the core of a planet or planetoid that was created during one of the big asteroid collisions early on in the solar system. Maybe like two planetoids crashed into each other, and what was left was just this revealed core of one of them. Psyche is on its way and will arrive at asteroid Psyche. Psyche is on its way and will arrive at Psyche in 2029. But in preparation for this, astronomers are trying to learn as much as they can about the asteroid. And so they've directed a lot of the large telescopes on Earth and in space at this target. And of course, one of the classic examples to use is the James Webb Space Telescope. And according to their analysis of Psyche, they detected the presence of hydroxyl molecules on the surface of this asteroid, this metal asteroid. Now, this is not the first time this kind of thing has been seen. And sort of like, think back. Do you remember when there was that discovery of water on the surface of the moon, not down at the poles, but just mixed in with the regolith? And there was like these initial discoveries, and then they used SOFIA to really nail down that there was actually water mixed in with the regolith on the surface of the moon. And so they first detected the presence of hydroxyl, which is like a relative of the water molecule. And then they were able to confirm that yes, indeed, there is water. So with Psyche, they detected hydroxyl. Where's this coming from? I mean, you shouldn't have water or even hydroxyl on the surface of an asteroid that is this close to the sun. So there's two possible explanations. One is just like with the moon, you've got the solar wind that's coming from the sun. It's essentially hydrogen that is bombarding the surface of Psyche. They're meeting atoms of oxygen, and then they're creating hydroxyl and then maybe water molecules. But another possibility that's even more intriguing, and I like this, is that you could actually have upwelling that is coming from underneath the surface of Psyche, that it still has volcanism, cryovolcanoes. We've talked about how there might be metal volcanoes on Psyche, but there could also just be like regular cryovolcanoes. And like, think about Ceres, which had these really strange salt formations on the surface of the asteroid, and it looks like that's having cryovolcanism. So Psyche is an incredibly weird world, and I cannot wait to see close-up images of this place. The WOW signal, deciphered. In 1977, astronomers were using the Big Ear radio telescope to scan the sky, and they received a signal that was so powerful, so unusual, that they wrote on it, "Wow," with an exclamation mark, and then they circled the part of the signal that's really weird. Now, when you look at the signal, you see this strange jumble of letters and numbers, 6EQUJ5. And people have always wondered, like, what does it mean? What is the code? Like, if you could just understand, like, what the 6 stands for, is that like a recipe for how to eat humans? Or is this a blueprint for a machine that's going to allow us to connect with the rest of the Galactic Federation? No, it is just the strength of the radio signal. So the normal ratings go from 0 to 9. And then if the signal was really strong, then it'll start to push into the letters. And so when you see the actual sort of strength of the signal itself, you can see how it starts out within the numbers and goes up into the letters and goes back down into the numbers. So there is no code there, but still it was surprisingly strong. And then what made it even weirder is that no follow-on observation was ever successful. So astronomers used many different radio telescopes. They scanned the exact same spot in the sky, and they never heard a peep from that area again. And so astronomers have been trying to explain what was the wow signal. Now, there are very mundane answers, like it is the reflection from a powerful radio signal emanating from the Earth and reflecting off something in space, like a comet or a satellite. And of course, there are very extreme suggestions, like it is a signal from aliens. It's being directed at Earth. But now researchers have come up with what they think is the most likely answer. And that's because they were able to find other examples of something like the wow signal in archived data from the Arecibo Observatory. Pour one out for Arecibo. This is this amazing giant radio telescope that was in Puerto Rico and collapsed a couple of years ago. But it had recorded tons and tons of data about the universe. And by looking through archival data, researchers were able to spot places where you had a signal that was very similar in the shape to the wow signal, and that this had been explained by a very powerful source reflecting off or passing through a blob of hydrogen gas. So you get maybe a magnetar or a pulsar or a gamma ray burst. It lets off a blast of radiation that passes through this hydrogen cloud, and then we get this burst of radio waves. So that seems like a pretty reasonable answer to what the wow signal is. And obviously, you know, if we find another example that perfectly matches, but the fact that there are several, not as powerful as the wow signal, but still sort of matching the same characteristics in this Arecibo data is pretty interesting. Now, my friend John Michael Gaudier just did an interview with one of the people behind this work, Professor Abel Mendez. And so if you want to sort of hear a very detailed explanation of what they think they're seeing, you should definitely check out that interview. There are some problems with New Glenn. So while SpaceX is building their Starship out in the open and we're able to watch in extreme detail every single advancement that they make, every mistake, every explosion, every successful launch, everything, Blue Origin has been doing their work in secret. And so we really haven't gotten a lot of information about what they're doing. We see the regular launches of New Shepard. We occasionally hear about various contracts that they've won. We've seen some testing of their BE-4 engines, and they're being used by the Vulcan rocket for United Launch Alliance. But we've been finally starting to see some progress from New Glenn. In fact, Tim Dodd got to do a tour of the facility with Jeff Bezos and do a walk around and talk about the rocket and see what they're up to and sort of learn more about their upcoming missions. And Blue Origins has a lot on the line. They've got a contract with NASA to launch their Escapade mission to Mars, which there is a very tight window to be able to launch missions to Mars. They've really only got a couple of months to be able to get this rocket together and launch it. And so in some recent testing, they suffered a bunch of setbacks. In one example, their upper stage exploded, and then a separate upper stage imploded. They were moving it from one facility to another, and the humidity and temperature changes caused the thing to crumple and implode a bit. So that's not good, right? Especially when you've got these deadlines that you've got to be able to meet. And NASA is waiting to be able to launch this next mission to Mars in 2024. And they've only got a couple of months before the window closes. And you got to wait until 2026. I don't know what the ramifications are going to be, what the implications are for Blue Origin, for the contract, for this mission. There's not time to move it to another rocket. So we will have to watch and see how this unfolds, but it's definitely a big setback. Citizen scientists find a star that's escaping the galaxy. Now, most stars in the Milky Way are trapped in here with us, but the occasional one yearns to break free and escapes the bonds of gravity from the Milky Way and flies off to explore intergalactic space. Now, usually that process begins with a very traumatic event. For example, a star is in a binary pair with another star. That star explodes as a supernova, and so the star is hurled out of the Milky Way, like with a sling. Or a star gets too close to the supermassive black hole at the heart of the Milky Way and then gets flung out. It has a gravitational assist. It gets thrown out of the galaxy. And so citizen scientists, so in other words, volunteers, have been studying data from NASA's WISE mission for interesting objects, and they found what looks like a brown dwarf that is moving at 1.5 kilometers per hour, which is fast enough to escape the Milky Way and is going to be on its way out into the universe. It's funny that I'm talking about this now because NASA just shut down NEOWISE, which was the extended mission for the WISE mission. And so with NEOWISE, it was searching for asteroids here in the solar system. But still, there's all this archival data that researchers and citizen scientists are looking through to find interesting things. So in this case, a brown dwarf that is on a hypervelocity trajectory leaving the Milky Way. Every week, we do a vote on our channel where you tell us what you thought was the best story of the week. And while there have been nail biters before, this was a landslide, and this was the potential discovery of subsurface water on Mars. Thank you, everybody who voted last week. Now, we will post a new vote related to today's episode within about 24 hours of when we post it onto the YouTube channel. So we put it into the community tab if you want to find it there, or just like while you're scrolling on YouTube, the vote might show up. Just take a second, let us know what you thought, and we'll celebrate it next week. Of course, the best chance to see the vote is to be subscribed to the channel, click on the notifications bell, and then watch a bunch of our videos to train the algorithm so that it knows what you like. That is space. JUICE makes a flyby of the Earth and Moon. The European Space Agency's JUICE mission is going to explore the icy moons of Jupiter, but before it makes it all the way out to Jupiter, it's got to make a bunch of flybys in the inner solar system so it's going to be able to both change its direction and get a boost in its velocity. And so on August 19th, we got a flyby of the moon by JUICE. And then 24 hours later, it made a flyby of the Earth. And so with the flyby of the moon, it gained 0.9 kilometers per second of velocity away from the sun. And then with the flyby of Earth, it got 4.8 kilometers per second of additional velocity away from the sun. At its closest point, it came within about 6,800 kilometers of the surface of Earth, and people with telescopes were able to watch it fly by. And this is the first time that a spacecraft has gotten a gravitational assist of both the moon and the Earth. And in addition to getting this gravitational assist, the spacecraft tweaked its orbit, and so now it's in line to be able to make a flyby of Venus. And then it's going to make a flyby of Earth in 2026, another flyby of Venus, and then another flyby of Earth in 2029, and then it's going to make its way out to the moons of Jupiter by 2031. I can't wait for JUICE to reach Ganymede and Europa, Callisto. Oh, it's so exciting. We know when a black hole will have its next feast. So black holes are normally quiet and invisible, but they occasionally can be detected when they gobble up some star or cloud of gas. And this is known as a tidal disruption event. It's a very clinical term for what must be a very horrifying process where a star gets too close to a black hole and just gets torn into this smear of debris. And then it can maybe do another couple of orbits before it all gets added to the accretion disk around the black hole and goes in, and then that's that. And so astronomers are detecting these tidal disruption events across the universe. And so in one case, they found one that's about a billion light years away. And they first detected the TDE in 2018. And then they saw it again about 600 days later. And from that, they were able to sort of figure out what they think happened. They think that this star was once part of a binary pair, kind of like that brown dwarf story. And the binary pair got too close to this supermassive black hole. They were broken apart. One was hurled on a hypervelocity trajectory out of the galaxy. And the other was then trapped in this orbit around the black hole, in this big elliptical orbit. And so based on the orbit, the astronomers predicted when they were going to need time on the Chandra X-ray Observatory to make their next observation. And so they booked time, August 2023, and right on schedule, they got the flare and they were able to make all their measurements. And so now they think they're going to see it again in March 2025. I don't know if Chandra is still going to be operational then. But that depends on whether the star actually survived the most recent flyby. Could be that it just was turned into spray. But if it does actually survive in some kind of chunk, then it'll do another one of these tidal disruption events. So just like set your watch to it. Get ready for the launch of Polaris Dawn. We are recording this on August 22nd. You're watching this, I guess, as early as August 23rd. But on August 26th, we should see the launch of the Polaris Dawn mission. This is where four private astronauts are going to fly to space on a Crew Dragon. They're going to launch to an altitude of 700 kilometers. They're going to spend 5 days in space, and then they're going to return to Earth. And 700 kilometers, that's higher than the International Space Station. They got a bunch of projects planned. One is they're going to do the first private spacewalks. They've got a new version of the spacesuit that they're going to wear in the spacecraft, with an umbilical, kind of like the Gemini missions, spacewalks. They're going to test to see if they can actually communicate with Starlink from above, which is going to be really interesting. They're going to have a laser connection to Starlinks. And like a lot of people always ask, could Starlinks be used to communicate with satellites at higher altitudes? Because they're all sort of directed down, providing us high-speed communication. And so this is a way to find out if this is going to work. And so maybe you could get internet service provider pointing down, but also pointing up into space, which actually would be really useful for a lot of science missions where you can't afford an entire ground tracking transmission communication system. You just, I don't know, pay for a package through Starlink. I was looking into launching a satellite, like what would it take? And although the satellite part is actually really easy to do, it's the communication part that was the showstopper, that there would just be no easy way to get the data off the satellite back to home because it's going around the Earth and you need to have tracking stations that can communicate with it and download the data. And so if this is just some package that could be offered by Starlink, that would be kind of amazing. They'll do a bunch of other experiments and then they will return home safely, we hope. So by the next Space Bites that you watch, we will be able to report on how the mission's going. So will they beat the Starliner astronauts home? Well, there's going to be a press conference in a couple of days, and we'll find out if NASA is ready to bring them home or they're going to come up with some other way. Now, while you are watching this week's Space Bites, I am busy writing my weekly email newsletter that I send out every Friday. And there are way more stories that we have in the newsletter than we're talking about here on Space Bites. For example, a European lander that could return an ice core for a fraction of the cost of a bigger mission. Could humans ever harness quantum vacuum energy? And the North Star has a surprisingly spotty surface. You can sign up to my weekly email newsletter. It's completely free. There's no advertisements. I write every word. Go to universetoday.com/newsletter to sign up. I'm going to talk about an interview that I did recently about the Plato mission. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Adam Schaefer, Barry Lake Roofing, David Giltinen, David Matz, Dennis Alberti, Dustin Cable, Jeremy Madden, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Paul Rohrbox, Spiderswap.io, Stephen Kusaki, Stephen Fowler-Munley, and Vlad Shiplin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all of our other supporters on Patreon. So you might have missed the new interview that we posted this week, and I think it was pretty special. And so if you're at all interested in the search for another Earth, an Earth-sized world orbiting around a sun-like star in the habitable zone, I think you'll get a lot out of this interview. And like, when NASA's Kepler mission launched, this was the space telescope that was hoped would find us that other Earth. It was going to stare at this one spot in the sky. It was going to watch for that telltale signal of an Earth-like planet passing in front of its star. It would have to watch for years without shifting its gaze for a second, because if you think about it, Earth is going to take 1 year to do one transit, and then another year to do another transit, and then another year to do a confirmation. So you really need 3 straight years of observations. And unfortunately, Kepler's reaction wheels failed and they had to ship the mission to find planets around red dwarfs, which happened a lot more quickly. And so now we've waited with no new telescopes capable of finding anything out about this. But now the Plato mission is due for launch in just a couple of years. And this should be the one that finds us dozens of Earth 2.0s. And we really could just be a few years away from this happening. So if you want to check out this interview with David Brown from the Plato Science Office, check it out. I highly recommend it. All right, we'll see you next week.